All right. So the name of the podcast is Application to Admission.
I want it to be HBCU versus PWIs, but you know, you think that's a little bit too aggressive. And I, you know, I don't want to be aggressive. I want to make sure that I treat your brother, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. right. You know, I don't come off too militant. Even though Martin was a real militant man, he has some really positive stances on a lot of things that people, you know, have diluted his message through this holiday and all that. But that's a whole nother episode.
Thank you all for coming. We are very, very excited, as Timothy, the other guy, just mentioned. He's Timothy L. Fields. My name is Shareem Herndon Brown. And we're going to talk about redefining success in a changing higher education landscape. Before we start, though, I just want to take a quick poll. I need to know who's in the room. Wow, standing room only. Looky here. Thank you. K through 12 educators, raise your hand. College higher ed educators, raise your hand. Community-based organizations, raise your hand. Others.
Welcome. So as Shareem said, my name is Timothy Fields. I'm Senior Associate Dean of Undergraduate Admission at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And we really wanted to take the time to have this conversation about the many changes that are taking place in higher education, specifically in the past 5 years, as far as with everything going on. But before we begin, we need to go back to 2020. And if we just take a moment to think about where you were at that time, maybe what you were feeling, depending upon what was going on within your household, things that we unfortunately saw in the news, the unfortunate murder of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, watching the bird watcher incident in Central Park. And then, you know, we were in the midst of a global pandemic. And so what we think of as 2020 is a racial reawakening of America. While a lot of people would like to think that desegregation and Jim Crow and all those things are far in the past, the reality is that it was just 70 years ago. And so while we look at the screen and we see these instances that were happening in 2020, none of them directly connected with a high school, a college, a university, but they had a big influence about the things that were to come.
Some of you may or may not know, but there was also something happening, particularly in summer 2020, where it's called Black at Instagram, where started with black students at predominantly white independent schools throughout the country, citing the micro and macro aggressions.
Sometimes racism.
Yes. That was happening about their experiences. You know, this was something that was near and dear to me. Again, I went to independent schools, grades 1 through 12, Brooklyn Friends School in Brooklyn, New York, Westtown Schools, a Quaker boarding school in Pennsylvania. I then went to Wesleyan University, Middlebury College for graduate school. So I have this very unique perspective of being an independent school alum, having then worked at independent schools, about four of them, and then sending my children to independent school. So for me, seeing these black at insert school Instagram pages really affected me, and I admittedly got angry. And it was important to me to say, you know, this thread, there was this undercurrent thread of college counseling where so many kids were citing the, I'm going to call it undermatching. I'm going to explain what that is in a second. How the black students felt how their college counselors were dealing with them or their parents in the process. So I took it upon myself, being the big loudmouth that I am, to call Timothy L. Fields, who, again, I knew he was the Senior Associate Dean of Admission at Emory. And I said, Tim, we should write a book about black families and college admission. Again, what would be unique about it is there were a lot of books about first-generation students and college admission. There are books written by very, very smart people that usually look at the top-tier schools or families of certain affluence. But I wanted there to be something in the middle for black families, much like mine, that were sending their kids to independent schools and navigating some cultural and financial dynamics as they live in the suburbs or so on and so forth. Let's talk about this undermatching thing, because we had Tim and I saw that a change was needed, right? The Black at Instagram highlighted that we had to address several things. And number one was undermatching. So what that is the presumption that independent counselors like myself or school counselors make about a student and resort to suggesting colleges that they're familiar with or have experience with versus suggesting colleges based upon who the student is. We particularly saw this, as per Instagram, Black and brown students felt that they were being suggested colleges that didn't necessarily align with what they wanted and or what their parents may have been expecting. For those of you who may have read Michelle Obama's Becoming, she dealt with undermatching as well. Her school counselor told her, I don't think you're Princeton material. And this is something that was happening throughout this Instagram thread. So it became the first thing that I wanted to address in our book, and Tim wanted to highlight a few other things.
And when Shireen called me, he initially, you know, wanted to talk about undermatching, wanted to talk specifically about college counselors. But me working on the admission side for the bulk of my career, I said there's a larger conversation that we need to have. And so one of the first things was I wanted to address narrowing the information gap. And how are students, particularly Black students, getting information about the college going process? There's data out there that says that 38% of Black students in this country get information from a family member or somebody within their household. This is in contrast to over 66% of students, white students, who get information about the college going process in their household. So this significant gap we wanted to address. How are students getting information? Is this information being relayed by people who understand their lived experiences, who are taking consideration all parts of their life? And so we wanted to create a resource to that anybody who wanted to could access this information. We also wanted to highlight historically Black college and universities. I'm a graduate of Morehouse College. Okay, so you got some HBCUs in the house. I'm a graduate of Morehouse College, but my sister went to Howard University. My dad went to Prairie View A&M. My sister-in-law went to Rust College in Mississippi. So, you know, in my life, there were all these HBCUs that were very present. If we go back to 2020, that year, anybody, corporation who had some money, wanted to give it to historically Black college and university. All of a sudden, these sports entities, NBA, NFL, everybody said, oh, we need to have something connected to historically Black college and university. And while that's great, these institutions have been around for almost 200 years. And so we wanted to, one, acknowledge the success and the foundation that they have played in the higher education system in the United States, but we also wanted to shine a light on the over 100 historically Black college and universities that are in the United States. So yes, I'm a proud Morehouse graduate. Morehouse gets a lot of notoriety. Spelman gets a lot of notoriety. Howard gets a lot of notoriety. But who's talking about Langston? Who's talking about Morgan State? Who's talking about the great work that's going on at Delaware State? And so these are the things that we wanted to bring to attention through our book. And then probably the larger thing that we wanted to address as we initially released the book in 2022, we went around the country talking, and then we saw a larger conversation that we wanted to have, that we're going to have today, is redefining success. What does success look like with all the changes that are going on, that some of them were catapulted by what happened in 2020, so families, students could be better informed about what is going on? So before we get into the conversation, as you can see, there are a couple of differences that we have. He would be described as fire, I would be described as ice. As we were waiting, we went back and forth 10 times on whether or not we were going to sit or stand. He likes
I'm
the pace.
I'm standing.
He likes the pace. He likes to walk. But this is the beginning of our differences. I was born in Dallas, Texas, Arlington, right outside of Dallas. I'm in Texas, so I can say I was born in Arlington, where people know. I'm a fourth-generation college student. As long as I can remember, I spent my life on a college campus. I talked about me going to Morehouse College, historically Black college university. I ran track and field and cross country, so had that experience. All of my career has been on the college side, working with people as far as accessing higher education, working with TRIO programs. I'm proudly wearing a shirt of Atlanta Metropolitan College, which when I worked was a two-year college, is now a four-year state college in Atlanta, Georgia. And then have all kinds of different experiences than Shireem. We were very different. I think the PC is a more user-friendly machine. He does not agree. Probably one of the few things we have in common is that we are twin dads. I have a boy girl twins that are 10 years old, and he has a girls that 11. Are 11.
11. So, yes, Tim being from the suburb of Dallas, sure, we're in Texas. I will clap for that. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. That implies whatever you want it to imply. There you go. As I mentioned, I went to independent schools all my life, went to Wesleyan University. Pledged a black frat, which gave me a little street cred with Tim when we first got together. But yes, most of my professional experience has been on the high school side. I enjoy working with students on their applications, right? So I did spend 1 year in college admission at Georgetown University, but I quickly learned that I prefer surveying the options. I didn't want to just sell Georgetown as an admissions officer does. I wanted kids to consider a variety of things. So my application side to his admission side has played very well in our dynamic with the book and our dynamic in this presentation. But the most important thing that I need you guys to answer me, again, I need honest truth. We're all transplants this weekend. Not everybody's from Texas. Thanksgiving.
Choose the right answer, everybody.
Stop. Thanksgiving, take a deep breath. Stuffing or dressing? I'll try that again. Wait. New York?
They got it right.
Stuffing the bird or dressing? Whatever. Bottom line is that as we've connected, we wanted to make sure that we highlighted several things for this conversation as we redefine success, but more importantly, also in our book. The first thing we wanted to talk about, what has changed, right? So we see that standardized testing is number one. It's important that we recognize, again, we're gonna go have another slide based on this, how much has changed since many in 1930 something ago, 30 years ago, took the SAT or ACT.
And we also wanted to talk about how essays are gonna play a bigger part in this conversation. And obviously, us being here, AI is a large part of that conversation. There has been an overhaul for the FAFSA. How is that, you know, influencing this process? The elimination of race-conscious admission, you know, how is that influencing this process? And then, you know, while these things are, you know, in the forefront, what we found as we were talking throughout the country, there's a growing concern over the mental health in this process. And that's something that we also wanted to make sure to address as we had this conversation.
So starting with the SAT, ACT dynamic, the SAT has gone digital. And this weekend, March 9th, will be the first time that American students take all digital SAT, meaning iPad, laptop. International was last year, but now going forward, March, May, June, August, SAT will now be digital. And that, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, it's adaptive now, which means it caters to a student's learning styles. But this shift, no more number two pencils and filling in bubbles, is significant. And I want to make sure that we understand how this is changing.
And as we had that conversation, I think it becomes very important that we talk about access. Who is this going to affect? I think it's, you know, very widely known that throughout the country, not everybody has access to good, internet, you know, depending upon rural areas. How many people have access to tablets, computers in the home, phones and things of that nature. And so as we move to this digital age, and yes, technology is great, but who has access to it? And we wanted to make sure to address that. But part of what's currently going on and what's been going on for the past 8 or so years is this idea of test optional. Now, test optional has been around since 1969. It was first introduced at Bowdoin College in 1969. But just up until 2017, there were only 900 test optional schools. So just for context, there are 4,000 colleges and universities throughout the country. 2,000 offer our bachelor's degrees. And in 2017, only 900 were test optional. The pandemic came, and then a lot of schools went to test optional. It raised to 1,900 schools. A lot of that was driven by people couldn't leave the house. You know, they needed to find other ways. to access testing. And so a lot of schools went test optional. But here within the past year or so, there have been several schools that have reverted back to requiring tests. So throughout the pandemic, the University of Georgia and Georgia Tech in Georgia required testing. In the state of Florida, they required testing. A year ago, MIT went back to requiring testing. And then just within the past month, Dartmouth went back to requiring testing. Then Yale followed suit. And so we see this shift back. And so, you know, one of the things that we went back and forth as we were, you know, doing our work as far as writing the book was, you know, in that moment when we started writing in 2020, Shereen was like, man, test option was going to be around in forever. You know, we can't, you know, say that people need to take tests. And I was like, no, I personally, as sitting in the admission side, and these are the thoughts and opinions of Timothy Fields alone.
Not Emory University, that's a disclaimer.
Said that, you know, testing is higher education's oil. That we can want to move away from it, but it's easy to a lot of people to say, what do these numbers mean? And that's a whole conversation for a different day. And then there's all kinds of different jargon that started taking place. Test optional, test flexible, test blind. What do these things mean? And so just very quickly, test blind are institutions like Caltech that say, if you submit a test score, we have no concern for said test score. We are going to evaluate your application based upon the merits of your grades, extracurricular activities, letters, recommendations. We don't care about testing. University of Michigan has chosen to go test flexible, where if you got one AP score you want to send, you can submit that. If you just want to submit the verbal score on your SAT, you can submit that. So you have options. And then there's test optional, to where you have the students have the choice. Do I want to submit my test or not submit the test? That is completely up to me. And so as we begin to think about how testing is going to influence it going digital, all of a sudden, you know, different parts of the process become a little bit more pronounced. And essays is one of those areas that are going to be very important as we continue to move forward.
So I have a bachelor's degree in English and African American Studies, a master's in English from Middlebury College, and I like the writing process. I used to teach fifth graders and seventh graders and ninth graders, all writing. So the essays has always been a big part to me of the college application process. Take a lot of pride in it.
You correct text messages. And
I do. Grammarly is on my phone. Absolutely. I don't see why not. But I think what's necessary to know about how colleges in this new higher education landscape, essays are being, you know, people are asking, do they even matter anymore, right? What's the point? And then there's the question about AI. How are students using it ethically or authentically? Let me start with number one, which is, do essays even matter? The answer is yes. It is an opportunity for students to share something unique about themselves to help them stand out. Their numbers are going to be what they are from their transcript. If they're submitting test scores, that's what it's going to be. The activities or, you know, what they've done outside the classroom. The teachers and counselors are going to write recommendations. The essay, in my humble but experienced opinion, is that it is a necessary component for a student to submit a personal statement about who they are and what's important to them. Now, let's talk about AI. At South by Southwest, it's a big topic. ChatGPT got, you know, announced last November, I'm assuming, you know, 2023. Bottom line is, it's everywhere. And colleges are trying to be proactive in doing trainings so that they can police it as much as possible. I am a believer that AI can be used ethically and authentically in this process. I don't like it when students are frozen with their fingers on the keyboard and don't know how to even start. So I think AI gives them an opportunity to get ideas out of their head, to see something on the screen, then that they can then customize it for themselves. I, being a big believer in essays, I will tell kids all the time, like a snowflake, there's only one of you, nobody else, limited edition. So you must use this opportunity to distinguish yourself from the pack. So as we've been, you know, going around the country, talking about not just our book, but making presentations such as this, we wanted to encourage you as educators not to fall victim to the essays don't matter. We don't want you to fall victim to, you know, is AI ethical, you know, and how can students use it authentically. We have to, as educators, find ways to support students in this new wave of artificial intelligence to be responsible with their essay writing process. Fair enough? One last point I need to make. As an independent consultant, I help a lot of students with their college essay writing. AI can democratize this process in ways that we've never seen. Kids who don't have access to expensive independent consultants or independent schools can use AI to proofread their work, to verify information, and that is important. I don't want anyone to think that this tool is of the devil. No, it can be a way for students who do not have opportunities and don't have resources to elevate their writing in ways that we're learning how authentic it can be. I would be remiss talking about college. We got to talk about money. Anybody know how much college costs these days?
A lot.
All right. Bottom line is, in my business, and I think Tim has adopted this, yes?
Yes.
To an extent. We say that the college search process, college admission process, application process, college admission process. You got to look first, then apply, then get in. In the search process, cost is paramount. Number one priority, you have to have conversations about money when your kids are applying to college, educators and parents. Number two is location. Number three is possible major, leaning into strengths of interest. Possible careers, number four. But today, I just want you to remember that if you're working with students as a school or a company, a CBO, always consider cost as the primary piece, the foundation of any college search process.
And so I saw a lot of hands go up who are individuals who work at a college or university. And so, you know, for those of you who may not know, the government decided the FAFSA needed an overhaul last year. And while I don't disagree with that, it needed some fixing. The rollout of this process has not gone well at all. In fact, I think there were some who would argue it is a failure because unfortunately it's disrupted a lot of students and families from being able to submit their information to college or university so that they can get financial aid packages. Shereem just outlined how important cost is, but if you are admitted to a school and you have no idea how much that school can give you, that creates quite the conundrum. At the same time, a lot of state public schools, two-year schools, smaller liberal arts schools are dependent upon federal funds. And because of this delay, that is also hamstringing the work that they can do. And so this is really having a detrimental effect on the college-going process. And we hope that it gets fixed, but we think it's very, very important that as we put costs at the front of this, that we, you know, understand what are the changes being made, you know, how are these changes affecting families, and even families who have been through the process 2-3 years ago, is the entire process is different. So, you know, one of the things that we really want to you to take away from this conversation is we have to continue updating our information. We cannot continue to go back to the same playbook. Hey, I helped a student last year. We can go do the same thing. And this new FAFSA is a big ordeal. You know, there are institutions like mine at Emory where we are very fortunate to have another mechanism, CSS Profile, in which is administered through the College Board, in which we can, you know, gather information and send out financial aid estimations to families. But a lot of schools in this country do not have the CSS Profile. So yet we're at another point of where we're at talking about access. How are people gonna, you know, navigate this process and what information do they have?
Newsflash, anybody know that affirmative action is dead? And anybody been reading the paper the past, you know, 9 months? This is a big deal. As a child of affirmative action, I am disappointed that on June 30th, 2023, the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action for race-conscious admissions. Why that is disappointing to me is because I think the colleges are the ones who are most affected. Now, I understand that the lawsuit was only brought on by Harvard and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're talking very selective universities. And do I think overall it's going to only affect schools of that ilk? Yes. Right? The selectivity is going for black and brown people. There will be fewer numbers on campus. We got to consider what happened in the University of California system. What happened University of Michigan? Those numbers went down, once they eliminated race-based, race-conscious admission. But because, and Tim does a great job of this, we have to remind students and families that over, 60% of the college universities in this country admit 60% of their applicants. So again, it's 50, maybe 100 schools that this will really, really impact, but I think it's even more damaging for schools, for kids who are on campus to learn during those very tender years of 18 to 22, when you live on a dorm with somebody you may have never considered living with, when you take a class and hear another perspective that you had not previously considered. So I find it challenging and disappointing, yes, that affirmative action has been struck down, legacy admissions has not, but the bottom line is, I don't call it doom and gloom.
You're not going to talk about athletics in Austin? You're going to let that go?
Today.
Okay.
I got to wash my mouth. But I want to make sure that we understand that we're entering this new era, again. So for all the changes that we talk about in higher education, this is the big one. And again, this first class, the college class of 2028, seniors who are graduating this year from high school, will be the first example of how this will work out.
And so, Shereem, just a very quick question. As we've gone around the country talking and we discuss this topic, one of the questions that comes up is, now that this decision is passed, should I write about my race? Should I write about my identity? Do I have to do that in this process?
Are you asking the guy who specializes in college essays?
Yes.
That guy. Absolutely. I think it's unfair for any student to submit an application where they don't talk about their lived experiences, document their lived experiences. And in some ways, colleges have forced their hand to write about cultural and racial differences. You know, I do think many schools are still adamant that they want to keep the diversity on their campus, but because students can't, quote unquote, check a box anymore, that they have to find a way to alert colleges to who they are and what's important to them. And for many times, that is oftentimes race or religion or ethnicity. I can tell you a story about, you know, this isn't new. I've had students write about, like, a powerful essay one of my students wrote many years ago now. So you can see how long that kid's been writing about race and ethnicity. She wrote an essay about how she was disturbed that when she and her mother entered their temple during a high holiday, that they had to sit in a separate part of the synagogue, that her brother and father sat somewhere and that the women were required to sit upstairs. And, you know, intellectually, the 17-year-old was like, here we are in 20-something, and this is still happening. So it was clear that she was Jewish. So she was writing about her race, ethnicity, her religious beliefs. Another family that I worked with wrote about having being multi-generational in the household. How, you know, the daughter was frustrated that she had to live with her grandparents and her aunt and her uncle, and how, you know, this was weird for a suburban New York family, but she gradually began to understand that in her Indian Pakistani culture, this was customary. And she started to embrace that and understand that learning the cultural traditions was something that she would want to share with her own children one day. So writing about race isn't new, but obviously, given the climate, given affirmative action, it's going to be highlighted, and I don't discourage it at all.
And so we started to think about, you know, a lot of the things that we have discussed thus far have been external. The decisions colleges and universities make as far as testing policies, they made those decisions. What the Supreme Court did, they made that decision. What happened as far as the FAFSA and the government, that was, you know, the federal government making a decision. But mental health is something that we all actively have to take a part in and take some responsibility in it. And so while a lot of it is focused on some of the most selective schools in the country, I recall a young lady, we were in Hartford, Connecticut last year, she raised her hand and she says, how can I stand out in this process? There's so many applications, admit rates are so low, it's so competitive to get into college. How am I able to get in? And I paused, and as Shereem said earlier, most of the college universities in this country admit over 60% of the students that apply. So when you're thinking about, you know, the pressure, the anxiety, and everything, you're talking about a small portion of schools. And so for the people who often want to look at those schools, and we're not disparaging those schools, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to just take a little bit of anxiety and stress out of this process. And so we wanted to address it and talk about who are all the, you know, informed parties, students, parents and family members, secondary schools, colleges and universities. And so we wanted to begin with students to really let them know you are enough. You have everything you need to be successful in life. You do not need to compare yourself to other people. You can find a college or university if that's the path that you want to go on. And then we also wanted to share procrastination does not help. Common App came out and said these are our writing prompts for next year. More than likely, the Common App is going to open up on August 1st again, and most deadlines are not going to be until mid-October. So students have plenty of time. So there are things that students can do in this process to make it a little bit easier. And then we wanted to talk directly to parents and say, and I'll put myself in here, we have to remove our egos from this process. I talked a little bit earlier about me going to Morehouse. I'm a very proud Morehouse man. I have a 10-year-old son. I would love if he went to Morehouse. But my wife will quickly tell me, why would you send that man to school only 15 minutes away from where he was raised? Does he want to go to a college that has all males? My wife went to University of Miami. She was there for two national championships. In her opinion, you know, football starts and ends with the University of Miami. She said maybe he can have that experience of being amongst 80,000 people. Maybe that's what he wants. And I have to step back and say, you know what? I don't know what my son, what position he's going to be in 8 years. But I can't let my ego, my desire for him to put on a maroon sweatshirt drive his needs. And so parents, we need to think about that. We need to articulate that message. We also need to, you know, not make this an everyday conversation. To just think about every day during senior year saying, hey, did you complete your essays? Hey, did you submit your test scores? Hey, did you ask that teacher for letters of recommendation? We had one of our colleagues who's been in the profession for over 20 years as his son was going through it, and his son said, Dad, stop. Like, we can't talk about this every day. And then they'd established that on Sunday afternoons, they would spend 2 hours to discuss the college admission process, and he said it helped the father and it helped the son as they went about navigating this process. I am finishing wrapping up our reading season, and I probably read this year about 1,500 applications, which is more than I wanted to, but it's part of the job. But each one of those applications, you know, had a high school that had a beautiful profile, said these are the course offerings, you know, these are, you know, our grading scale, you know, this is the setting of our high school. It was very informative. But on a lot of those on the back, he says, these are the schools our students matriculate to. And often they were the same 75 to 100 schools, leading families and students to believe these are the only schools that I can be successful at. And I think that's something we need to address to expand the list to the many different college universities that are not only available here in the United States, but throughout the world.
Before you go on, I have to say one thing. We wrote this book together. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that this mental health chapter, which is part of our second edition, the first edition came out in September 2022. Johns Hopkins University Press, our publisher, understood that so many things were changing in higher education. We asked them if we could do a second edition. Very quickly, it came out in January. We wanted to highlight, obviously, the Supreme Court decision. We wanted to write about AI and essays. I took the lead on that. And then we want to talk about mental health. Because again, as we've been touring, so many parents, families been asking, about what about the mental health of kids? Don't tell him this, but Tim wrote in an amazing chapter about mental health. It is hands down the best, the most necessary chapter, because if we are educators in this room, we care about the kids first. And what's happening to them, because of their procrastination sometimes, because of their parents projecting onto them, or because high schools are saying, hey, these are the 75 schools we have relationships with, we have to remember what it's happening to them, and I hope that you understand. I'm going to say thank you for writing that chapter and for saying what you're going to say next.
So, did y'all record that? Somebody got that? Please, I need that for later.
Shh.
And so the last part is where I, you know, as somebody who has been in admission in higher education for the past 25 years, we as college universities have to take ownership, and we have to stop waitlisting and deferring as many students as we do. If we know a student isn't competitive in November, they're not going to become more competitive in April. Go ahead and pull the Band-Aid. Allow that student to expand their list, to think about other places that they can go, as opposed to saying, hey, we'll defer you in November, and then get to April and says, yeah, we weren't able to admit you. Why have students go through that process? And so we, as college universities, need to rethink the enrollment model as far as that we're using as pertains to deferring and waitlisting students. There also is another population not listed that is also guilty in kind of this, you know, kind of the anxiety and mental health, and that is publications that have lists.
Shh, U.S. News and World Report might be here. Be cool. We're brokering relationships. Calm down.
Like I said, we need to, like, think about these lists and what it says. So, you know, a couple months ago, ran across, you know, this article that said the best colleges for future leaders, 100 schools. So I'm not a big advocate of rankings and lists. However, it's a part of our society.
Hold on.
I have some Air Jordans on. And if we want to talk about the list, who's the GOAT? Everybody knows it's Michael Jordan.
LeBron.
But all that to say is I understand they're a necessary part of society, but what are they signaling?
You're being too measured about this. I understand your ice on fire.
But I'm a calm person.
But you were angry about this list. Let's keep it real for the people. When you saw this list come out, the best college for future leaders, you were upset, similar to how I was with the Black at IG. Why were you so upset that this list came out?
I was upset and disappointed because I did not think the list was representative of many great college universities.
You're going, go deeper.
Can I talk, please? Was not representative of many great college and universities. Now, on this list of 100 schools, there was not one historically Black college or university. On this list of school was no Hispanic serving institution, no tribal colleges. There were only 2 women's colleges lists. All 100 schools were predominantly white institutions. Great schools, but I thought something was missing. Now, I was a little bit, my feelings were a little bit hurt. Morehouse wasn't
little,
on there.
A little bit.
But I was disappointed that Spelman College wasn't on there. So if you think about the rankings for the last 17 years, Spelman has been the number one HBCU, if you want to use rankings. Been one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. And it could make the list. But then personally, as a Morehouse graduate, I was like, I know several mayors of major cities throughout the country, doctors, lawyers that were classmates. I think about Samuel L. Jackson, the highest grossing actor of all time. Think of Spike Lee. And then I also think about, if we're going to use the word leaders, there's one holiday named after a Black man in this country, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and he went to Morehouse College. So I'm looking at this list saying, what does it say to our students if we are saying that these are the only schools? But the reality is there are a lot of schools with successful people that maybe weren't on that list.
But thankfully, we came up with a few that didn't go to Ivy League schools, but I think you would consider Tim Cook a pretty good leader, that multi-billion dollar company that he leads.
I think it's moved beyond billion. It's trillion. It's something big.
Auburn University, great school, but not known as the Harvard of the South, right? Known for SEC football primarily. But the bottom line is that's where he got his engineering degree. Anybody know where Oprah Winfrey went? Tennessee State, HBCU. Would you consider her pretty successful? All right, so remember, we're redefining success. But we want to show that Tim Cook, Oprah Winfrey, you continue.
David Stewart, one of the richest people in the world, went to University of Central Missouri. Mary Barrera, who's a GM at General Motors.
Kettering University.
In Michigan. Where's my Detroit people at? Where they said, oh, there we go, Detroit. And then there's a listing of other, you know, top corporations in the country where their CEOs went, and most of those schools were not on this listing. And so, yes, we look at this list, people who are highly successful that a lot of people may know, but there are successful people that are in this room and that you know every day.
So, there we go, standing up again. I'm willing to bet that if you looked in your phone right now, you don't have to pull them out.
Who has a cell phone? Raise your hand if you have a cell phone.
All right, there you go. I figured that. If you look in your cell phone right now, you don't have to, but just pretend you did. And the last 10 people you spoke to, I would tend to think that you think that they're pretty successful, right? Or they wouldn't get your time. So the last 10 people you spoke to, I'm willing to bet, and again, I don't have any money, so don't hold me to this. One, if that went to an Ivy League school, and I'm not here to bash Ivy League schools, I'm here to say you're talking to successful people every day, and there's a good chance they didn't go to a subset of schools that we in this country too often talk about in the New York Times. So in your own life, you're redefining success. Your children, your students are having you communicate with people who are going way beyond schools that are tucked away in the Northeast or in Durham, North Carolina, or in Palo Alto, California. And we have to continue to do that because of all these changes in higher education, testing, mental health, essays, affirmative action. It's a big kind of tornado. And I think it's going to negatively affect Black and brown students more than most. But regardless, we have to collectively, as educators, really redefine success.
So we would not be doing a good job of educators if we did not have some takeaways. What are things that we want you to leave this conversation with? The first thing we'll say is recognize how much change has taken place in the last 5 years and how this is going to affect us as we move forward. To recognizing these changes are going to affect, you know, various populations in different ways. And, you know, we're not going to know how the affirmative action is going to affect us. We're not going to know how the, FAFSA is going to affect us. We don't know what this digital testing is going to look like. All these things, but we need to know that they have changed and we want to continue to stay better informed about what's going on so we can better prepare our students, our families, and our communities as far as what's going on.
Keeping an open mind, that's a huge takeaway, and I'm going to get a little personal just to close us out. So I have 4 children. I have 3 daughters and 1 son.
Is he your favorite son?
I have 3 daughters and 1 son, thus he is my favorite son. He's left-handed, he loves baseball, and when he was very early, 6, 7, 8 years old, my dad told me, he's a lot better than you were when you were that age. He's throwing 90 miles an hour at 15 years old. Got a verbal commitment from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to play baseball there. I am ecstatic. We get the Carolina gear. We put it on Instagram. Ha ha, we're done. Gets a 30 on his ACT as a sophomore. Done. Right? Pandemic hits. Carolina calls 2021, April 1st. I'll never forget the day they called my 16-year-old son, not me, and say, due to the pandemic, we have kids with extra eligibility, so we're no longer going to be able to offer you that scholarship. Whew. He's upset, he's crying, tell his baseball coach at school, who puts it out on the APB, hey, you're going to be fine. If you could pitch for Carolina, there's going to be plenty of people who want you. Princeton University calls 3 days later. My son was a student at Georgetown Prep at the time, said, hey, we would love for you to take that lefty arm and come pitch for Princeton. My son,
your son,
says, I don't want to go to New Jersey. My wife just walked out the house. I can't. I don't know whose child this is. Just walked out. But again, okay, he's a teenager. It's a pandemic. It's a lot going on. I'm trying to be understanding. So give him a gift. Send him to IMG Academy for his senior year. You know, the pandemic was killing us all. And he officially had the little signing day with the hat. University of Missouri, SEC baseball, we're pumped, we get the shirts, I have twin daughters, at the pictures, blah, blah, blah. Oh my God, this journey we've been on, he's going to Missouri, he's happy, he feels validated. Went to the MLB combine and everything, Let's go. 2 days before he graduates from high school, Missouri calls and says, hey, I'm on the hot seat, and I got to bring in some transfer portal kids from the community colleges, so I'm going to have to redshirt you. And I'm like, you got to be kidding. 2 days before he graduates. So my kid, devastated. We have a great advisor. He lands at the University of Memphis for his freshman year. Okay? Playing Division I baseball. He didn't play much. He was a freshman. Had some bumps in the road. But here he is. End of the year, the head coach takes another job at the University of Missouri. Decides not to take my kid with him. My son is now playing baseball and had a great outing on Saturday. 6 shutout innings, 7 Ks, 2 walks. But he's playing baseball from Miami-Dade Community College. That was never the plan. But life is not linear. And when my kid told me, Daddy, because of your job, I feel like I'm supposed to go to a certain kind of school, I said, forget it. Whatever. I don't care where you go, what you do, I need to talk to you when you're 30. So we're living this with you. We're redefining success. Carolina, Princeton, Missouri, Memphis, Miami-Dade. And I want us all to continue to do that, not just to keep in mind, but to have a plan, right? Even when the plan goes awry, at least you had something to follow. And when you follow that plan and life is not linear, at least your kids know that a structure was put in. And again, the structure that my kid had was that he had pretty understanding parents who were being very resourceful, great agent, advisor. And bottom line is he's in the place where he's supposed to be right now so he can hopefully get back to where he wants to be, you know, next year. He's 19 years old, living in Miami in a $2,500 apartment with a car. He's doing all right for himself. And lastly, we want you to understand the choices. We intentionally named our company Understanding the Choices because right now we feel like people need to know that there's 4,000 college universities in the country, some 2,000 which get 4-year degrees. We need you to understand how things are changing. But through all that, highlighting HBCUs, AI and essays, understanding the choices is something that if educators, parents, students do, we honestly believe that everything will be all right. So thank you so much for hearing us. We appreciate you for attending and continue to redefine success.